Well, welcome back, everybody, to the podcast for cultural reformation brought to you by the Ezra Institute. The Ezra Institute is a Christian world and life view think tank and training organization, and we engage culture and we equip believers of all ages to think Christianly and apply a biblical world and life view to every area of life. And we do that through in-person training and conferences and through print and digital resources. And we are again this week on location. You might be able to see from the backdrop here, this is a little bit different from our usual setting. And we are with a special podcast today on location on Lake Erie at the Worldview Youth Academy. And we have two of our fellows here with us today. And so we thought we'd take this unique opportunity to have a discussion with two of our key leaders and speakers within the Ezra Institute. So one familiar face who you see often, Dr. Mike Thiessen. He's our fellow for marriage and family at the Ezra Institute. He's also our director of ministry development in the United States. And we're also joined by Dr. Aaron Rock, who is our fellow for church leadership. And he's been lecturing at the Institute's program today. And so we're going to have an opportunity to talk about the issue of marriage and masculinity. And we recently, a few weeks ago, touched something on this subject. We talked about some of the issues, but Dr. Aaron Rock has been addressing this with our students. And this is something also that Dr. Mike Thiessen was addressing with our students in the United States in Tennessee a few weeks ago. So we've got an opportunity for a great conversation today. So gentlemen, thank you very much for joining the podcast today, and looking forward to having a chit chat about these critical issues that are affecting men in particular. So do we have any other commercials, Michael, that we need to be aware of for today?
Family camp.
Yes.
Coming up August 25th to 28th. We still have openings. So if you're interested in that, please go to the EzraInstitute.com, and we'd love to see your family there. We're about 60% full, and that's a great inaugural year, but we're happy to pack it out. So come join us in Minnesota for a great time.
And that is Lake Country, right, Michael? I mean, this is the area we're going to is considered one of the lake countries in the United States, right?
Areas. Minnesota's like the Northern Ontario or the Southern Ontario Lake Country, Muskoka area. It's going to be fantastic. So
yeah,
make sure you sign up. And Aaron and I got haircuts for the podcast. We're both ready to go.
I took it right down to the wood.
It's looking good. Aaron's, I like it.
A little bit more drastic, but you've had a trim, Michael. That's great.
Literally with a comb and Nate Wright just messing around. So
we should probably tell him not to give up the day job. Especially since we're talking about masculinity today. All right, well, look, let's get into our subject a little bit today. And where I wanted to start, and Aaron, let's start with you, because you've been lecturing on this today, and we can riff off this a little bit as we discuss it together. But one of the things that you were talking about to the all of the students, actually, and then with a focus on the young men this afternoon, was this whole area we're in today, where a kind of new thing culturally, I mean, effectively, if you look at it historically, this new thing, this new development in the last 100 years, some might even say less, actually, more like 60 or 70 years of dating. Mm-hmm. In the past, maybe our grandparents would have called it courting. It's this sort of period between developing a romantic interest in somebody and marriage. Mm-hmm. And our culture really has introduced all of these sorts of expectations of sexual experimentation, of independence from parents, and so on and so forth for this area in life. And it's, of course, affecting marriages and family. And you dealt with a number of issues this morning in your lecture. One of the areas that I thought was particularly noteworthy was when you talked about the necessity of, if you want to be married, and of course there are Christian young men and young women in the churches, and there'll be younger men and women listening to this podcast who, you know, they want to be married,
right?
but there's the whole dating game, and then there's fear of what that means. There seems to be especially fear with young men, and there's a lack of understanding of actually what that whole period between courting and marriage is meant to be about, and how we actually prepare ourselves for marriage. Mm-hmm. In a culture of, you know, failure to launch, how do we prepare ourselves for marriage? So could you start there? Could you just talk to us a little bit about what were you helping the students understand today about preparation for the Christian idea of marriage that is in free fall in our culture?
Yeah, I think it's a critical issue. Every year, Susie and I both take about 10 young people each. I'll gather about 10 younger guys in our church. She'll gather about 10 younger girls in the church, and we'll put them through about an 8 to 10 month discipleship process. Invite them to our home every other Sunday night, and we talk about these kind of issues. And what I find fascinating is the more simple and basic I can make it, the more likely it is they've never heard of this before. Mm-hmm. We're sort of like missing the forest for the trees. And these are really, really important things for young people to think through. So yeah, whether we call it dating or courtship, you know, we can wrestle with better language, but there's going to be a natural period of time where you're intensely exploring, I guess, the will of the Lord for whether or not this is the person you should marry. And we'll just, for the sake of our conversation, we'll call it dating. And what I wanted to help the young people to think about is, first of all, the purpose of dating. And in our culture, it might be, well, so that I can just have someone on my arm so I can go to the movies with, or someone I want to kiss or make out with, or I don't know, I'm just dating because it's the thing to do, or I'm 12 years old, but I want to have a girlfriend or boyfriend. And what I was suggesting is that it's better to think of dating as a question and answer period before marriage. So the primary purpose of dating is to explore whether or not there's compatibility, obviously theologically, but also in terms of general life direction between a man and a woman, to see if it's the Lord's desire for them to marry. And the most basic piece of advice, which I give to young people, is that I say to the men, if you want to date, you should act like, drumroll, a marriable man. Mm-hmm. And to the young ladies, if you want to date, you should act like a marriable woman. Not, oh, I'm going to date, and maybe 5-10 years from now, I'll get around to being marriable. No, if the purpose of dating is to explore God's plan and intention for you as to whether you should be wed, then you should come into that relationship as an acting and thinking and living your life like a marriable man. Mm-hmm. And that shouldn't fear people. That should make people afraid. That should give people a motive to grow up and mature and act like a marriable adult. And obviously for men and women, that's going to look a little bit different. We talked about the men demonstrating initiative. And, I differentiated between spiritual authority and spiritual leadership, because a lot of times Christian young men are not sure about that. And I suggested that you can demonstrate spiritual leadership in a relationship without having spiritual authority over that girl. Mm-hmm. She's not your wife yet. You're not in a covenant. You have no spiritual authority over her, but you should be exercising spiritual leadership. You know, you should be leading in prayer. You should be leading in biblical conversation. You should be leading in setting boundaries to establish purity and whatnot in the relationship. So act like a marriable person. See dating as a trial period, a period of time where you are asking good questions, mm-hmm. where you're trying to role model your values, where you're living life together in various contexts, and seeking to determine whether that is the person that God has in store for you. Yeah. So instead of just spinning your wheels and just going on dates for the sake of going on dates, no, it's a Q&A period. You're asking questions, you're giving answers, you're asking the other person questions, they're giving answers to try to determine whether there's compatibility for a future marriage.
Michael, I want to flip to you in just a second with a qualifying question on some of that. Before I do, though, Aaron, what should be the young man, he's a Christian young man, he's wanting to date a young woman, a Christian young woman, what should be his attitude and posture towards the parents, towards, in particular, the father? Now, that might sound, when we say things like this now in our culture, unless you're a big Jane Austen fan and you're watching Pride and Prejudice like me, you know, these seem like totally foreign and almost bizarre questions today to many, even many Christian people. We've been so affected by the culture that the notion that you've got any obligation to talk to the parents if you're interested in dating a daughter seems almost ridiculous, you know, so old-fashioned. Why would that be necessary? Can you just say something about that? You know, young men listening to this, they might be 18 through 30. What should their posture and attitude be towards the parents, especially the father of the woman they're wanting to court or date?
So my counsel to young men is, first of all, to make sure you have a thoroughly biblical understanding of male headship. So that's ground zero. You need to, you know, read Genesis 1. It's there in the first chapter of the Bible. And, you know, both men and women are made in the image and likeness of God. But a man is there to lead and guide the relationship, and the wife is to be the helpmeet. So part of spiritual leadership, even in that dating process, is to start to demonstrate your commitment to that principle. And one of the best ways that young men can demonstrate their commitment to that principle is to demonstrate a high regard for the spiritual authority of that young woman's father. Even if he doesn't get it, I mean, even if he's a lost man, even if he thinks it's weird. So I say to young guys, look, you take a girl out, let's say for a coffee, just kind of trying to get to know her a little bit. Maybe you go out a second time, maybe a third time. By the third time, you're probably getting a sense of whether or not you're going to start dating or entering into some sort of a little bit more long-term relationship. That's the point when you need to go have a conversation with the father. Call the guy, sit down with him, take him over coffee. I required this of the men that dated my daughters. And, you know, you have to give me a shout. We sit down. I know it's a little bit intimidating. You're sitting down with this older guy, but it's good for you. It's mm-hmm. good for you to man up. It's good for you to feel a little nervous about that. And you ask for his blessing. Is it okay with you if I date your daughter? I'm going to be honorable. I'm going to treat her properly, but I'd like to date your daughter. And with his permission, then you enter into the relationship. Now, the genius of that is at least twofold. Number one, you're communicating to your potential future wife that you value male headship mm-hmm. just by asking her dad. And number two, you reinforce to that father that you honor his male headship over the home. Now, oftentimes, young men will be like, yeah, but what if he's not a Christian? Do it anyway, mm-hmm. because it's a creational thing.
Yeah.
And you may actually turn a light bulb on in his mind and remind him, oh, yeah, I guess I am this. My daughter's spiritual head.
Yeah.
So that's a great way to start off the relationship. And then on the heels of that, so let's say you go out 1, 2, 3 times, the fourth date, just to make it simple, before the fourth date, you have a conversation with the dad. And then I say to the young guys, the next way that you demonstrate spiritual leadership is on date number 4 or date number 5. You say, hey, you know what? We need to talk about boundaries. So mm-hmm. at the beginning of the relationship, I want to make sure this is an honorable relationship. And, you know, I don't want to dishonor you or dishonor God. So that's when you have a conversation about sexual boundaries. Mm-hmm. And if you're not man enough to have that conversation, you're not man enough to be dating.
Right.
So it might be a little awkward, but you say, hey, you know, I want to honor you. I don't want to be doing this, 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 and this. I don't want to be doing anything, frankly, in the relationship that would cause you to be sexually stimulated. That's for marriage. I want to enter into an honorable relationship. You have that conversation. You say it out loud, the cards are on the table, everybody knows what the boundaries are. You're only going to be blessed by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a pity, I was saying to you earlier, that, you know, when we look back to our late teens and early 20s as young men 30 years ago, this is not the kind of teaching that, for the most part, that we were receiving. It was not talked about. It wasn't addressed. This has been a big slip up. This has been a big error in the history of the life of the church in modern times, that these things have not been talked about seriously. Michael, I wanted to put to you just something coming out of what Aaron has been saying. What would you, as a pastor, as a leader, say to this now very, very typical common occurrence that, you know, and I come across it all of the time in my work as a cultural apologist. You and speaking to different churches and conferences and groups, where parents have got their kids dating at like 14, 15, 16 years of age. They're in these sort of serious dating relationships. And you've got fathers just this is like water off a duck's back. They don't even think about it. I would say, you know, I don't want to go too far, but I'd say it's almost the norm that in the average evangelical church today, that parents have their children dating as children. I mean, you know, I was very clear with my children, both the girls and the boys, from the very start. You're not entering into any kind of courtship type of relationship until you're 18 years old. And actually, one of them's 22 right now, one of them's 20. That's the two older ones, my girls, and neither of them have had a dating courtship relationship yet because they're picky. they've got standards. Yeah, why what not? Do you see? Yeah.
And why not be?
Yeah. Exactly. What do you say to the Christian parents listening to this? Perhaps they just have, you know, we don't want to condemn them. They haven't thought about this. They accept the culture around them. What do you say to them about the whole purpose of courtship and dating when they've got a daughter who's 15 years old and she's in a serious dating relationship, or a son who's 16 in a serious dating relationship?
Yeah. So I really like the word that Aaron used, marriable. I call young men and women to be men and women of standard, of biblical standards. Mm. So a proverbial male, like what does the book of Proverbs say to a young man that he ought to be? And what does the book of Proverbs say to a young woman that she ought to be? And in this context, we've already answered the question early on, and a 14-year-old cannot date and act like a marriable person. And there are a number of scriptures that talk about it. You cannot scoop hot coals into your lap mm-hmm. and not be burned. And so to these parents, I always talk about this in the concept of, so, because it's interesting when you're saying, Aaron, you're, you know, have a serious conversation with her and tell that you don't want to, you know, cross any boundaries. And what I was thinking in jest, the way a typical male would be thinking, well, tell her that you want to, but you're not going, because that's partly the issue. Men are entering in to dating relationships for a physicality. They're hoping for the physical nature of the relationship to change. And so to these parents, I would be saying your young children cannot, they can't, they're not on a quick path to marriage. They're not acting even with the worldview and the age to be able to act as a marriable or a standard young adult. They're still a child. And so for me, you said 18. For my kids, it's you've got to have a pathway to marriage, meaning if you feel that you're being pulled to date, then my questions for you would be, if this were to go somewhere quickly,
what's the plan?
What is the plan, and are you capable? Because that's another measurement for me. So character and competency are both two things that the book of Proverbs talk quite a bit about. Competency is different than character. Character is your moral quality, your moral integrity. Competency is you've done some stuff before and you can produce. I think, Aaron, you use that word produce as well.
Now, we're not saying, of course, that both of you guys would say, we're in a culture which excessively delays marriage, right? Which tries
right.
to end totally so, put so the balance there. Talk to us a bit about the balance, because
yeah.
we don't want our kids putting off marriage into absolutely. Their 30s and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And we should be raising them so that they are marriageable
yeah.
at the point of maturity. So just yeah. maybe just comment on that before I pivot back to Aaron with a
yeah. So start dating later, start courtship later. Mm-hmm. Loved all the stuff that you were talking about, Aaron. And then the opposite of what culture says, get married when there is undue strain. So 1 Corinthians 7 talks specifically about a young man, if he feels like he's treating his girlfriend, his girl, the Greek is just the girl, his girl in an impure way, mm-hmm. they should be married rather than burn with passion. And the text talks about- and
that's why it took me 4 months to get married.
It's just that easy. Like I like how you said, like we have about four or five dates And if you don't have a pretty good understanding about where this could and should go, either end or go towards marriage, you're not really dating with intention. You're not dating as a person who is attempting to get married. Mm-hmm. So start everything later and then encourage your children to get married young. If they're demonstrating maturity, that you date to get married.
Yeah.
And there should be no arbitrary boundary put up to a young adult going, I love this girl. I've brought this girl home. We've entered this really well. And now things are heating up. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, that takes us, doesn't it, to the reformational perspective, the heart of the marriage relationship, which qualifies it differently to a mere friendship, is that it's one flesh union. It is, by definition, a sexual relationship.
Yes.
So you shouldn't be trying to pretend that you're ready to move into that kind of a situation or be dating at 14 when actually it's not realistic for you to be marriageable in given circumstances until 18 or 20 or whatever it is. You're asking for trouble because the very nature of the relationship you're moving towards, by definition, is more than a friendship. It's a sexual relationship that distinguishes the marriage from other forms of friendship. Yeah. You've both used the term marriageable, Aaron. And you mentioned it early on, and we talked about, okay, you know, we should only enter into this kind of serious courtship when we're marriageable. Can you talk about some of the things, and then maybe Michael, you can think of a couple of things as well, that you think, what are the things that, especially for young men, but we can talk about the young ladies too, what are the things that make one marriageable? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it from the male perspective first, since you're a bit of a macho guy.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for that. We need to be able to bench press at least his own body weight. Be incredibly good looking. I think Genesis tips us off to that. And that probably the most fundamental thing would be initiative and everything that flows out of that. Mm-hmm. Biologically, men initiate in the sexual union. Spiritually, we are to initiate, we are to protect. A man needs to be willing to protect his wife physically, spiritually. We are in our own biology. There's a manifestation of that. We're larger. We're physically stronger. So that communicates something about our purpose, mm-hmm. Is to protect and defend our wives. It's not that our wives are, you know, weak little pushovers, but we have greater strength and it's our job to protect our wives. We also are to initiate. We're to initiate spiritually. So men need to be analyzing and assessing their relationship. Like, are there things in this relationship that are maybe a little off? Is there unresolved conflict? Is there maybe a sense of despair that has crept into our relationship? There seem to be tension in the house or passivity in the house. We shouldn't have to wait for our wives to tap us on the shoulder. I mean, sometimes they will, but tap us on the shoulder to deal with those. Part of a male initiative is not just responding to your wife's requests, but initiating, guarding the union. And you can start to demonstrate those kind of character qualities in a dating relationship. And so you should. Again, a difference I would say between having authority over her. You don't have authority over her until she says, I do, but you can still show spiritual leadership. Mm-hmm. You can show a sense of direction in life. So some very practical examples, let's say a young guy wants to go on a date with a young girl and, you know, he calls her whatnot. First of all, you don't text. Okay. You make a phone call.
There was no such thing as texting in our day, was there? We didn't text a girl. You talked to a girl. There weren't any texts.
Be a man. Don't show, don't send an email. Don't send a text message. I mean, actually have a conversation. Yeah. I know it's intimidating. I remember those days, but you call her up and, hey, you know, I was wondering if maybe you'd like to go out. And she says, yeah. So the next question from the guy is now, well, where would you like to go? Oh, I don't know. Where would you like to go? Well, I don't know. Where would you like to go? That's not leadership. You know, you initiate, say, hey, I'd like to take you to, and, you know, name the restaurant or the coffee shop or whatever. These little things, we often win or lose in these little things because those little things are expressions of the bigger thing. Mm-hmm. Are we men that can see around the curve in the road, that know the direction we're headed, in our relationships, and are we willing to actually lead? So in these little things, initiating prayer, initiating spiritual conversation, learning to ask good questions, a simple question like, hey, what's one of your greatest highs and lows right now? I mean, that opens up the door for all sorts of talk.
Yeah.
What's God been doing in your life lately? What have you been learning? These open-ended questions that show spiritual leadership, yeah, and spiritual direction, yeah, are important. You don't have to sit there. I mean, you're allowed to ask questions like, you know, what's your favorite sport, or, you know, do you like dogs or cats or whatever? I mean, you can have casual conversation. That's part of life. But inserting these meaningful, thoughtful questions, mm-hmm, any godly woman will pick up on that, mm-hmm, and really appreciate that.
And that's something you have to cultivate anyway, isn't it? I mean, one of the things that you said during your lecture was that, you know, marriage is sanctifying. Mm-hmm. You don't arrive in marriage knowing it all, you know. 25 years on, 30, and I've been married 25 years, I'm still learning things. There's still areas where I can think, you know, I've been too passive in this area. You know,
initiating. If we're on the podcast right now, they'd have a lot. Yeah, of
Jenny's
fun.
Been sending Susie emails.
Hotel, getting some advice, I suspect. But I remember when I was courting Jenny, we were writing letters to each other. You know, that we've lost the art of letter writing. But there's a sanctifying aspect of marriage when you're courting. There's a sanctifying aspect to that, as well as you're learning some of these lessons. And, you know, you talked in your lecture about, you know, the sin of Adam, in a sense, in the Edenic situation in the garden, was his passivity, because a conversation's going on between his wife and Satan, and he was there, and he's not doing anything about the situation.
Playing video games.
He's, yeah,
he's video games.
He's playing the first video game, or yeah, trying to make one.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is something where, you know, we have to continuously grow. I mean, mm-hmm, you know, recently one of the things I've been trying to do is say, you know what, let's because you get busy with the children, yeah, and the you know, all the busyness of life and travel and ministry, it's like, let's have a conversation about some of those things that we used to talk about when we were first courting. Let's talk about hopes and aspirations, and it's amazing how that increases intimacy and so on. So that's all really good, both for the marriage relationship and for, as you say, courting, becoming marriageable. Michael, what would you add to Aaron's pretty comprehensive coverage there? I mean, you know, to
literally every time you pass the baton to me, you try to make it clear that I can't add to it.
Anyway,
not to me. Yeah, it's good. Sorry, we just received a text.
No, actually, wearing tight shorts.
This is really important. That the concept of intentionality leads to, of course, why the man is to be the head of his home.
Yeah,
that he might be potentially an elder in the church. Mm. And this is a major, like, all of the stuff that you've been talking about, Aaron and Joe, we talk about this 3 weeks ago on the podcast. We talk about this regularly. Part of the reason that you want to be a marryable man is so that as a married man, you have proven yourself to the greater community of the church, that you are the initiator, you are the manager, you are the governor of your home, as we see in 1 Timothy, as we see the list for men. This is actually why it is theologically absurd for female pastors to be promoted,
right?
Because it is the exact undermining of the mayor role in the home and in the church. And Aaron, as you describe things, I'm sure that your church family appreciates your haircut and they appreciate your preaching all that much more. Because the way that you verbalize things, I'm sitting there going, there is not a young woman that I would know, a mature young woman that I would know, that would not just, their heart would be pounding going, that intentional man, that's the man,
it's the guy
I'm looking for, and how much they appreciate it. Of course, we know this within our marriages. The moment we ever do anything like that, it just goes well, because we're fulfilling our God-given responsibility. When we do it in the home, then we actually, and I think you said, like, seeing around the corner, like, how many guys where you look at them and they're not leading their wives, there's no intentionality in the home, and then you come into a problem in the church and they can't even see like they literally can't even see the water on the floor of the gym mm-hmm. and how to solve a little problem like that with rather than, you know, solving, you know, mm-hmm. advice for someone's marriage or do we enter into a mortgage for the church building or there's a church discipline issue. How do we walk through that process? And so this idea of intentionality is so important because it is the actual, it's our playing field by where we're tested to then be actual leaders in the church. I would also just add, and I think you should riff off of that connection between husband and elder. I think it would be a good place to go. I always tell young men they need to be able to produce. If you want to be a marriable mm-hmm. man.
Yeah, for sure.
So
diligent, productive.
You need to be able to protect. You also need to be able to provide. Yeah, like go after it. Provide for your family in a way that allows your wife to focus on building the home, in you know, literally birthing children, rearing them, and doing all the wonderful things she wants to do in the home because you've taken that role to produce seriously. Yeah.
I'll just add one comment. I've observed that a lot of men don't want to do that because they're lazy, mm-hmm. because they think laziness is easier. But laziness is actually more difficult in the long run.
Yeah.
Hard work is easier. Hard work is better in the long run.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
When you lead, when you initiate, there's less conflict. You get better kids. You sleep better at night. Laziness always leads to chaos.
You mentioned
disaster.
Yeah. You mentioned our physical makeup before. Lazy men are weak men, are fat men, are like, you're absolutely right. Laziness never bodes well mm-hmm. for anyone physically or spiritually in any way.
Yeah. It should be added to what you were saying, Michael, that you know, when you talk about eldership, that model is, you know, scripture says, he who desires to be an overseer desires a good thing.
That's right.
And actually, and if you aspire to that role, these requirements that we're talking about are being marriageable are actually in these That's descriptions right. about somebody who governs well, who's leading, who's producing, who's got a good reputation, all of the things that make a man attractive to a woman. You know, look at that guy. He works hard. He's diligent. He's faithful, and so on.
His children obey him. Like, it's all there.
All these things are what make for somebody who should then aspire to be an overseer and a leader and somebody who mentors others. I was going to add one quick thing to what you guys have said because I think it's related to the intentionality issue. And this applies, of course, within marriage, but it applies before marriage in this courtship phase we've been talking about, which is you have to have a cause and a vision bigger than yourself. It can't just be about you, you know, what's Absolutely. Your life about? Well, I want to make money.
Right.
You know, I want to be successful. Yeah, but is there a cause that's greater than you? So this idea of a kingdom vision that the Bible lays before us, a dominion mandate, a kingdom vision for men to rally to, for young men to rally to. So my life, you know, we say to our wives and our fiancés, those that we're courting, my life is oriented to Christ. Mm-hmm. And my concern in life, in whatever he calls me to, is the advancement of his kingdom and his purposes. And I need a helper, a partner in that. Will you join me?
Yeah.
Will you go with me and let's go together, you know, to serve the Lord in our lives as parents, and in our vocation and whatever it is that this is actually unto the Lord, which is, of course, what when there's direction given to husbands and wives about mutual submission and so on, and the headship of the man and the roles and responsibilities, it is, you know, submit to your husbands as to the Lord,
right?
Mm. Right. It's we're doing this for Christ.
Yeah.
And if it's just about us and it's all selfishness, that those kinds of relationships steadily implode, because when the person that you're romantically interested in, and you think, oh, they are going to meet my needs, they're the fulfillment of my dreams, and you enter into the marriage relationship, and as human beings, fallen human beings who aren't God, can't answer to that, disillusionment, you know, when expectations aren't met because they're false expectations, relationships fail. So that sense of a kingdom vision, if you can cultivate that as a young man, as a young woman, as you're entertaining marriage, that there's something, you know, that we're doing together, we're on mission together in terms of the kingdom of God.
Connect that to the concept of going and talking to the Father.
Right.
Because you're going to her spiritual leader, her spiritual head. You are communicating that you have that vision, building that relationship. This is not just about me scoring you. Yeah. This is about me walking for Christ as Christ laid down his life for the church. Mm-hmm. This is me walking in this way. And one of the ways is me getting permission from your spiritual leader that he's checking that my kingdom vision is there. Like, that's where this whole, I love all of our parents, but I just don't know where that generation got their training.
Right.
Or they didn't get their training on this, because it all connects. It's all so powerful.
Yeah, to your point, Ephesians 5, right? Marriage is literally the gospel on display.
Yeah.
So the husband's role is to basically represent or represent Christ to his wife. She presents herself to him as the church.
Mm-hmm.
He leads, she responds in submission. He loves and she submits, and things work out well. So that the Christian husband and wife are literally communicating the gospel to the watching world.
This is why
divorce, by the way, is so egregious.
That's right.
Because it's basically a denial of the gospel.
Yeah.
Saying, I don't want to be Christ to my wife anymore. Well, I don't want to be the church to Christ. I want to usurp, or I want to run off with some other Messiah or whatever it might be. This is the major offense of divorce. It's not that, well, you offended me or I offended you and I left, but you're actually twisting and distorting the gospel. So this is where we have to think of, help people to think of marriage as more than something that's just of benefit to you. Of course, it does benefit us.
Yeah.
Adam was lonely. God made him Eve. He's in the garden for probably a few hours.
Yeah. Not good for
him. And it's not good for a man to be alone. And there's benefits of companionship and mutual discipleship and all that sort of stuff. Even as the husband leads, the wife is discipling her husband as he is discipling her. I mean, all of us here could probably tell story after story of times in our wives as our spiritual sisters spoke into our lives and corrected us or helped us to see things differently. And we're grateful for that. Mm. But ultimately, when it comes to the trajectory of the relationship, it is the husband's responsibility to lead. And all of that is under Christ. You know, at the beginning, we talked about this widening gap. So our model would be, you know, wait until you're coming up to adulthood to date and then get married relatively soon, right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to specify the exact number of months, days, and weeks, but you keep that gap short.
Yeah.
What the world's done is they've spread it out.
Yeah.
Date really, really young, get married much older.
If at all.
It gives you let's say you come into puberty at 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, let's double that. Now, let's keep the person 15 years in dating world or bachelor world for this period of time. Well, that way you can have sex with multiple people, you know, party hard and all this sort of stuff. And we're creating a whole generation of people that are less and less competent to even conduct the most basic duties of a marital relationship.
Yeah.
And it's a ploy of the devil. We know ultimately it's satanic.
Yeah.
Let's make this gap so long that of course everyone's going to compromise.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, how many 30-year-olds that started dating at 15 are getting married at 30 as virgins?
Yeah.
Probably almost zero.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they've compromised in other areas as well. So these are things we need to address. And again, being very
practical. Which makes you twice as likely to be unfaithful in marriage, by the way.
Absolutely. I said to the group.
Before marriage.
I said to the group, there's probably some exceptions to the rule, but I don't do too much counseling anymore. But in my many, many, many years of counseling, whenever we would deal with married couples where there's an affair or some sort of sexual compromise, you ask some question like, well, did you have sex out of wedlock? It's always yes, always.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't personally, maybe there was one or two, but I don't personally remember anyone that said, oh no, we were chaste up till our wedding day, but all this stuff started afterwards. People bring their trash with them into marriage. Marriage doesn't fix the problem.
Yeah.
They bring their trash with them into marriage. And this is why it's important. Part of acting like a marriable person is to be a person of integrity and character in advance of saying I do.
Well, all of us have been, you know, pastors for many years in different contexts. And I have to say, you know, I was just thinking as you were talking there, Aaron, and I don't know what your experience is, Michael, but it's very hard for me to remember amongst all the premarital counseling that I did with younger couples, dealing with a couple that it hadn't had sex with other partners prior to this or hadn't struggled sexually and were sleeping together prior to getting married. And so these issues that we're talking about right now, these are not fringe issues. This is central now to the meaning of marriage, the meaning of the gospel, as you said, as Peter Jones, one of our fellows, likes to call it, the cosmological key to the universe. This is the sacrament of, not sacrament in the Catholic sense, but this is the marriage is the sacrament of Trinitarian theology and the covenant between God and human beings. It's the sign of that. It's a symbol of it. Let's just, in the last few minutes here, talk a bit about the second element that you were talking about, Aaron. The lies that men believe that actually hinder them from wanting to move forward with identifying a suitable spouse, being serious then about being marriageable, courtship, and then not endlessly delaying marriage. And you were talking about how that's actually driven a lot by lies within the culture that we believe, and that hinders us. Can you talk to us about some of those? What are some of the lies that younger men believe today that are hindering moving forward in this era and actually us living up to the biblical standard? Because if we're going to recover Western civilization, we have to get this bit right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll put them all into the heading of fear. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're all into the heading of fear. That's the response to these lies. And I know this well, because when I disciple young men every year, and I sometimes challenge them, I say, you know, I don't understand. Like, you seem like such a good man. You love the Lord. There's like 100 single women in our church. Like, what are you waiting for, bud? And many of these guys initially don't know how to respond to that. But when you start to talk to them about it, you discover it's fear. Yeah. I'm not sure that I can do it. I'm not sure what she'll think. I'm not sure I've overcome all my issues. So it's fear. And that fearful response, yes, comes from lies. So one of the lies is that men and women are totally equal in terms of their function, in terms of their capacity, in terms of, you know, everything else. We would say, no, they're ontologically equal. They're both made in the image and likeness of God. But men and women are different. And that's part of what makes relationships beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's part of the mystery of pursuing the other for life and never really figuring that person out fully, because they're so different. There's, you know, there's lots of jokes. There's lots of jokes.
Pursuing the other for the rest of your life without ever understanding the point at all.
I've said this many times. One of the sources of conflict in marriage is not understanding that that's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of the joys of marriage is, like, when my wife does or says something, I'm like, man, I still don't really understand her. there's mystery there, but it also motivates you to try to understand that person better.
Good.
Mm-hmm. It's like marriage is sanctifying. Marriage is wonderful. But the point I want to make is that men and women are not the same. We're not the same. Now, I was using an illustration from the political realm. So let's take our beloved leader in Canada, Justin Trudeau, who would be the first to march in a transgender march, or the first to insinuate that gender is fluid, or you mm-hmm. can pick your gender, all this sort of stuff. Like, apparently there's no such thing as gender anymore. But then he appoints as the head of our military our first female general. And all he's talking about is our first female general, female general. It's like, oh, interesting.
Diversity hire.
So suddenly gender does matter, and suddenly you're acknowledging gender, but in other situations it doesn't matter. Well, this is all a subtle attempt to say to men, actually, you don't matter.
Yeah.
You don't matter. So it only cuts one way. It doesn't cut both ways. They elevate women. They're always talking, oh, a woman got this role. A woman was appointed this. It celebrated women's accomplishments, but men aren't celebrated in our culture. Men aren't honored in our culture, especially honorable men aren't honored in our culture. Now, you can be honored as a man if you act like a woman. And I think on a deep psychosocial level, that's why so many men are acting like women, because they know that's the way to get honored, right? That's why you have transgenderism, for example.
Men are trumpeting what wonderful feminists they are, for example.
Yeah. So there's young men, and it's probably more subconscious and conscious, are unclear on what maleness is and how that's different than femaleness. And they're not quite sure how to approach or interact with a woman. They're also told they're sexual animals and deviants. I mean, the Me Too movement brought that to the forefront. So in a court of law, we've always said you're innocent until you're proven guilty. But the Me Too movement inverted that. Mm-hmm. Now you're guilty because you're a man until you're proven innocent. Mm-hmm. Well, that causes men to walk on eggshells because they don't want to be, accused of things they didn't do or accused of saying things they didn't do. So that's another lie that men believe. A third one that I shared is, well, you're just going to be like your dad anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, suppose you have a wonderful father and you're like, well, I'd kind of like to be a lot like my dad. But, many of us come from backgrounds where we love our fathers, but our fathers had some significant deficits in their lives, right. Or even in the case of my own, love the guy to death, but he's not a born again believer. So, looking at the breakdown of my parents' marriage when I was 10 years old and all the drama and the pain that came out of that, it's an intimidating thing. Like, I don't want to repeat the sins of my forebears, yeah. Right? I have a keen interest in family history. And, I was researching my family history a little bit. And I'm like, oh, okay. So my parents divorced and my grandparents had they were expecting their second child before they got married. I didn't realize that. And then, mm-hmm. My great-great-grandmother had her first child out of wedlock. And it's like, is this like a generational curse? Is this like a generational, sin here? No, I don't believe in that, but it can undermine a person's confidence, mm-hmm. right? It can undermine his confidence. And so these are all things we need young men to be able to talk through with seasoned older men and lies they need to crush. And then obviously, you crush lies by replacing it with truth. So we need people to have a robust understanding of manhood. But I'll tell you this. I told the young guys this today, we not only need to teach our young men to have a robust understanding of manhood and masculinity, they also have to have a robust understanding of womanhood and femininity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not that we teach the biblical doctrine of womanhood to women and the biblical doctrine of manhood to men. Mm-hmm. Men are going to lead that whole relationship. They need to have a proper understanding of what a woman is too and what her role is and how she thinks and how she sorts through the issues. And we're not going to expect the same kind of insight from guys in their 40s and 50s as we are of an 18 or 19-year-old. Mm-hmm. But men need to be affirmed that as you submit to the law of God and read the Word of God and are empowered by the Spirit of God, yeah, you may not be as experienced as we are in sorting through these issues, but you can do it. Mm-hmm. And God wants you to do it. Mm-hmm. He wants you to lead.
Yeah.
So go for it.
Yeah. Michael, what other lies has the culture told young men that's hindering Christian marriage, that's hindering our impact culturally as a Christian church?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest lies is that pornography can be satisfying enough that I don't need to rush to marriage. Like I've gone through puberty. I'm a man now. I have testosterone pumping through my body. There is an attraction to women there. And instead of pursuing a godly course, remaining pure and seeking to be married young and knowing your role in the relationship and how you're going to lead her, setting all of that grand vision that we've been talking about aside, and thinking just because there's some release, just because there's it's not worthy pursuing the Lord. So I think believing that lie that's a mm-hmm. satisfying lifestyle. You always, Joe, we're on the show. You always make jokes about staying at home playing video games. Like if a guy's up at 1 o'clock in the morning with his laptop open, like. Mm-hmm. It's video games or something else. Mm-hmm. And that's it, And so they can be captivated and they can be drawn into kind of like a complete alt life. I'm up late doing all of these things that are unproductive. And that is supposed to be satisfactory, which even in the mystery of pursuing our wives, who we don't fully understand, we know the richness of that. That's one thing, as we've had this conversation, sexuality is such a beautiful intimacy. You know, after 25 years of having a sexual relationship with one woman, being mm-hmm. faithful to her and her being faithful to you, you understand the concept of faithfulness in a way that I don't think you can learn that in any other way other than being in that relationship mm-hmm. on earth mm-hmm. because you're hitting your 50s and your wife is there not because of this thing that you think it is. She's there because she's faithful to you and she loves you and she is fulfilling her God-given calling and responsibility. So
it's not about your chiseled abs anymore then, Michael. Is that what you're saying?
Well, those help.
Yeah, they're up here now.
Yeah.
You know, just jumping in on that.
Yeah.
The pornography issue, which is such a huge issue today for men.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, the way men are visually built.
Yeah.
And the technology that frankly we didn't have to deal with when we were young men.
Yeah.
You know, you had to break through all kinds of social taboos to access pornography when we were teenagers. You know, go down to the store, you'd have to walk there, then you have to ask for something under the
Is it a female clerk today that I'm gonna a 14-year-old try to sneak around?
These barriers that were there that actually prevented you you know, whereas now at the touch of a button on your phone or on your laptop, I think we know from, and you know, actually we frequently address this issue with the young people at our training because it's so important.
Yeah,
we know that pornography doesn't provide intimacy. It's a world of diminishing returns.
Absolutely.
That's why pornography is addictive, because it actually, and actually this has been scientifically established, the studies have shown this, is that actually certain, when you have a sexual relationship with a human being in a committed relationship, certain endorphins, certain chemicals are released that give you a sense of satisfaction, of fullness, of peace, right? That aren't released with the use of pornography. It's a depersonalizing situation. Absolutely. And that's why it's addictive, because it's a world of diminishing returns. The person is always looking for the next experience to try and get that feeling of intimacy and fulfillment and satisfaction, and it never arrives. And I think it's important to say, you know, for young men especially, as they're contemplating marriage, that the pornography is not an example of how you behave, is not the model of how you behave sexually with a woman in the marriage relationship. And porn, as we know, is increasingly violent and abusive and depersonalizing.
Drugging these women up, intoxicating them. Yeah.
But we also know that, and this has to be said, I think, that's very, very important, is that the use of pornography is prostitution. And I think that's, we have to get that into our minds. This is not some harmless pastime. The people who are making those films are essentially prostitutes. They are paid to engage in sex in front of a camera for the titillation of the viewer. And so you are essentially engaging in prostitution the consumption of pornography. And I think we have to, if we think about it and recognize it in those terms, you know, we know it's exploitative. We know often the age that young women enter prostitution and then often end up in the porn industry is very, very young, 13, 14 and so on, drugs, all of these things we know. We could do a whole episode on that. But I think, you know, the book of Proverbs tells us, doesn't it? Don't go down to the woman's house, right? You know, the father is saying to his son, avoid the loose woman, avoid the seductress, the one who is going to try and draw you away into unfaithfulness and so on. Avoid her, the way is death in that direction.
That's right.
And we have to recognize that pornography is simply an accessible form, an easily accessible form of prostitution. It's diminishing returns, it's totally destructive. Aaron, do you want to add to that?
I think that one of the lies that we believe that frankly Adam and Eve bought into in the garden was that God is a cosmic killjoy.
Right.
He's holding out on you, right? So the fruit, he knows you're gonna be like him, and you know, and we need to remind ourselves regularly that God is actually a benevolent ruler, not a cosmic killjoy. So therefore, one would expect that any time and every time, in fact, we violate God's word, that there's a consequence to that. And there's a consequence to pornography. And there's a couple consequences that come to mind that are being talked more and more about, even in the broader culture. One is erectile dysfunction.
Yeah.
So we have men as young as their mid-30s who have been addicted to pornography that can no longer get an erection, which is required for sexual intercourse. Mm-hmm. So they're ordering the blue pill. Mm-hmm. This isn't for 90-year-olds. This is for young men.
Yeah.
And this is leading to increased instances of impotence in young men.
Young men in their 20s, even.
And culture sees the opportunity for profit. Mm-hmm. Doesn't want to confront the root issue about it.
Create another medicine for it.
So they create another medicine for it. When in reality, the problem is being addicted to hiring prostitutes.
Yeah. So it's like surprise. Yeah. When we live our lives according to God's laws, and this makes people snicker, I think, at times, and maybe in part it's intended to, because it helps it be more memorable. But we could say without question, Christians have the best sex. Mm-hmm. When Christians are obeying God's laws and they're committed to their husband or wife for life, your sexual life increases. And we're not just talking about the mechanics of it, trust, the intimacy, the loyalty,
That's
the giving,
important.
The giving of self-giving, the self-giving. There's so many people in the world that have never, ever, ever experienced that because they've just given themselves away to all sorts of people.
Yeah.
And they've literally worn themselves out.
Yeah.
And so one of the consequences of pornography is
it takes up all your sexual energy, wears you out.
Wears you out. So in our church, and I think in many churches, we're increasingly hearing stories of what I would call sexless married couples who are married, but they're virtually or hardly ever having sex anymore. Mm-hmm. While they're expressing their sexual appetite someplace, you're like, what? Wait, they're married, but they're not having sex? Yes, they're married, they're not having sex, or maybe once or twice a year. And there's often like emotional issues there, but when you trace it down, there's almost always some sort of sexual compromise in the mix. So even people pursue marriage in part because they want to be able to enjoy the sexual union. And God did create the orgasm, not Hugh Hefner. Mm-hmm. It was God's design to create our bodies, our genitalia, to create sexual pleasure. These are all good gifts from God, and we shouldn't be ashamed to let our young people know, like, God created these things. God created these responses. Mm-hmm. This is how much God loves you. He created these wonderful things that we appreciate. Yeah. And yet we destroy them because we constantly try to substitute them with false versions of the good creation that God gave us. Mm-hmm. So instead of Eve, you got a digital Eve. Instead of Eve, you have a plastic blow up Eve. Instead of Eve, you have whatever, multiple Eves on a given night. And all of these destroy the intimacy that God has in store for us. So we need to champion the benevolence of God. The reason why he puts these laws into place are because they're for our good. And I think even in my own life, because we all struggle with sexual temptation as human beings, reminding myself of the consequences of sin mitigates the temptations. That's not going to help me, so I'm going to shy away from that.
Well, and that's what actually came into my mind, Joe, when you were talking about the actual legal... The legal breaking of God's law. We've got mixed categories here. Like when the Old Testament law makes it very clear that it is unlawful to engage with a prostitute, like punishable as a criminal offense. And so we need to these categories that have shifted in our culture, we need to re-speak about them legally in order that we might turn around and go, That's very severe. And it's always good to think about the severity of sin. And I actually also really appreciated, Aaron, as you're commenting there, that God did design these things. Why is it that we always question God and think that we're going to figure out something new that humanity has never discovered before? Because
a better way of doing it.
Yeah.
No, it's worse.
No,
it always leads leads to chaos and disaster, broken relationships.
I think that's a great place to leave it. God's order, God's creational purpose is always the place where our humanity, he made us, where our humanity truly flourishes. Human flourishing is only ever in terms of God's order and God's normative structure as he made it. And wherever sin tries to distort that or misdirect it, destruction, misery, despair, disorder, chaos is the result. And so trusting God in all of this, and actually maybe a word to our listeners, that even those of us who may be listening who have less than ideal marriages, where they feel let down in some way by their marriage, maybe they're in a sexless marriage, it's not without hope. Don't yes. despair, right? Help, you know, there are Christian marriages that are misdirected, there's distortion, there's failure, there's disappointment, but it is never too late to see the reordering, the restructuring, where that couple is willing to see that marriage redirected to the glory of God and see tremendous fulfillment and joy again in the marriage relationship.
Yeah.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Michael, Aaron. Fabulous to have you with us again this week. And thank you both for your time. That's it today for the podcast for Cultural Reformation. And we will look forward to seeing you again next week. And all that remains for me to say is from him and through him and to him, including marriage, are all things. To God be the glory.